Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Intel Optane memory faster than lightning, people. Which hard drive should you buy? Is AMD Vega around the corner? New monitors from Dell and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 412, recorded April 27th, 2017. Opting for Optane. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter the promo code TWITCH to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, most delightful news about PC hardware. We love Macs, we love Android, we love iOS, but today, I think we have more than a little bit of love for Intel's Optane memory, 32-gigabyte review, quote, faster than lightning. And joining us today, Mr. Alan Malventano from PCPer.com. Tell us about the Optane miracle, sir.
It actually is faster than lightning. I was curious as I was working on my bridging the gap chart, which is, the thing I added to the previous review and to this review, which is just showing, like, a floppy disk all the way to, like, how fast is a clock cycle of a CPU, right? So I kind of put all the different storage mediums in the middle there. Lightning actually comes in at like 30 microseconds. The access time of your regular SSD is 100 microseconds. Access time of Optane memory is 9 microseconds.
Now, when you say lightning, are we discussing lightning the stuff from the sky or lightning the port? The stuff from the sky.
How long does it take the bolt to travel up and down, right? Like, that's pretty quick.
Pretty cool emails stuff about lightning traveling up. We'll explain the physics later on.
It's basically a mini version of the thing you guys talked about last week, which was the Intel Optane Enterprise drive. This version only has one or two of those crosspoint dies installed on it. That gives you 16 or 32 gig of storage, which you figure is not a lot. Like, you're not going to be installing Windows on this thing, but that's not the intended purpose. The purpose is to just plug this in to a system that has, preferably a system that has only a hard disk installed. And, you install that Optane module, you install a driver, and basically it just gives you a enable button, like a really big one. And then you just kind of hit the button and reboot, and you're off to the races. This thing just starts acting like a cache for the hard disk. I did a bunch of timed tests. I think they're on the next page in that review if you're flipping through it there. Pretty much whenever you have the hard disk alone is painful. Like, whenever you're just trying to use a hard drive in a system, I mean, especially if you're used to using a system with an SSD in it. Optane memory being enabled on that system will bring your times down to basically SSD type speeds. There's that chart with a whole bunch of different, like, boot time went from 47 seconds down to 6, which is actually 4 seconds faster than that same system would boot off of a SATA SSD. Pretty interesting. It was right in line with how fast an NVMe SSD, like a 960 Pro or Evo would boot, right? And if this is a little bit of a trick, but like, you can actually enable Optane memory on a SATA SSD. It doesn't have to be a SATA hard disk. And in that case, it actually brought the boot time faster than trying to boot from a 960 Evo by a second.
Yeah.
So
yeah, which yeah. It, depending on how you look at it, is a lot of time, like a 15-18% reduction, so much time because it's like 3/4 of a second there.
Right.
I mean, the primary target for this is going to be people who, like, I want a 4 terabyte hard drive. I'm not going to pay $1,000 or $2,000 for a 4 terabyte SSD or more. What's the pricing on Optane memory look like? Right, I know you basically need Kaby Lake, the most recent chipset.
Yeah, you need 7th generation. Updates. Yep, you need 7th generation. You need most recent any recent firmware, like if you had an early Kaby Lake board, then, you know, you might need to update your BIOS before you try to enable this. It has to be a core 7th generation CPU. So you can't put like the Kaby Lake Pentium in the system, as we discovered earlier today, actually. And it wasn't like, we're still a little confused on what's so special about the core thing in Kaby Lake that like makes it a requirement. But you know, we did notice that earlier when I was testing something at the office. So that's kind of a downside, right? You have to have current generation stuff. There is still Intel Smart Response Technology, SRT, which was that thing that came out like, I don't know, probably 7 years ago now, where you can take an SSD and you can act, you know, you can tell the system to use that as a cache on, you know, any hard disk, right? SRT actually still works. Like, you know, that's still a thing. And I even, just earlier this morning, we took the Optane part, plugged into a Z170 board, which normally wouldn't do Optane memory caching, like as far as caching your system drive. And we were able to turn on a cache using Optane memory of a 4 terabyte hard disk sitting in that system as well as like a secondary drive. So you could theoretically use this still on older systems, just maybe not in the, you know, in the absolute intended purpose of, you know, like the, if you had the 7th generation hardware. It does show up as a regular SSD. I actually put two of them in a RAID and made a 64 gig drive. And we ran some testing on that too. And we have some results in the article on that too. If you were to get three of these and you had a motherboard with triple M.2 that was capable of RAID, you could theoretically have like close to 100 gigabyte SSD full of Optane if you want to go really crazy and be all power usery, right? But again, not the intended purpose. Intended purpose is just have a relatively low cost thing. In this case, the 16 gig part is, I think, retails $44. 32 gig part retails $77. I would imagine OEMs can get them for cheaper, you know, in volume discounts and whatnot. So you should be able to see, you know, the idea is take your typical OEM system that would be cheap enough that it only came with a hard disk and make it not as painfully slow as that system only coming with a hard disk, right? You need to do something to make it a little bit faster, right? And in this case, Optane memory, like it works, like it does its job. You know, there's just, as far as people that might want to upgrade, there's a couple of gotchas right now because, again, you need all the, you know, newest hardware to fully support it on your platform. But, you know, down the line, this makes a great stocking stuffer for, say, the family member that bought a system now, and then a couple of years down the road, say that the system didn't come with Optane memory in it. As long as you know that they're on 7th generation hardware, you know, this is something that's like, you know, cheaper than $50 you could get and make their system perform in most cases as if it was using an SSD, right? It doesn't magically make everything SSD speed. If you run something for the first time and it hasn't gotten a chance to be cached into the Optane module, you know, it's going to run hard drive speed the first time. But conceivably, the typical things you're going to run on your system, and especially in the case where you have the 32 gig version, a lot of things, like we were playing Doom, we were playing Ashes Escalation, I was installing Windows into a VM that was stored on the disk, right? So that was another whole OS installation worth of things to potentially cache. And that VM was running at SSD speed as if it was sitting on an SSD, and I was launching Doom and Ashes, and they were launching at SSD speeds, right? And rebooting the system, and the reboot time was still, you know, much closer to the SSD speed than it was the, you know, almost a minute hard disk speed. So, you know, we were doing kind of power usery things to try to roll off the cache and make it, you know, kind of catch it, you know, with some uncached things and cache misses where it had to go back to the hard drive. But it was doing a pretty darn good job. You know, and again, some cases it actually made the hard disk system faster than the SATA SSD system. So, you know, didn't really see that many negatives there other than the hardware requirement, you know, on newer generation stuff.
I like that idea, but, you know, when you're looking at the retail pricing for this, we're talking about $44, like almost $3 a gigabyte, $2.75 a gigabyte for the 16 gigabyte version, $77 or $2.40 a gigabyte for the 32 gigabyte version. would it make more sense for some people to pick up something like a Samsung 850 Evo,
you know, and just use SRT
or M.2 drive and just use, yeah.
So here's the thing with SRT. You need a Z series board. Only the Z series boards supported SRT, right? Whereas with Optane memory, Intel has opened that up, and granted, it has to be a seventh generation board, but it basically supports like what looks like almost all of them. So even if it was like a B series board or just, you know, things that would normally not be a power user type thing, right? Typically what would pretty much any seventh series motherboard that comes in an OEM system is probably going to have an M.2 slot and be able to support Optane memory, whereas it wouldn't be able to do SRT.
Okay.
Yep. So
just checking, because I felt that question coming on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It already has in like Reddit threads and whatnot that I've been following. So, you know, so it's, you know, it's something that would be able to, you know, because the Z series board is going to cost you more money, you know, than the much lower end, you know, other boards. So, it's kind of a kudos to Intel for, you know, kind of just deploying this across the whole series. And, you know, in my opinion, it performs better than SRT would, you know, and if you count the additional cost you would have to pay for the Z series system, then it probably all balances out as far as how much that part costs, right? You know, yeah.
It also helps. Like, I'm looking at a Western Digital Blue 4 terabyte desktop hard drive. That's $170. You know, which is that plus the 32 gigabyte version of the Intel Optane memory module, which is $77, is still a staggering amount. It's like, you know, $1,200-$1,300 less than you would be paying for the for an SSD of that capacity. So that's one way to put that into perspective.
You know? Yep. And again, like, the more of these they sell, the better the price will eventually be coming down on this stuff, right? I mean, it's a brand new storage technology. Like, think about it. Like, you know, it's when flash memory came out, it was not like 20, 30, 40 cents a gigabyte, right? Like, it started really high. So, as a matter of fact, like the X25M, like that 80 gigabyte SSD that Intel first launched, that actually started my whole career in journalism because of an issue with it, right? But I bought that drive. It was 80 gig. I spent like upwards of $700 on that SSD.
Right.
That was more than $2 per gigabyte, you know, that this stuff is starting to ship for. Yeah. So, you know, just consider it's a brand new memory technology that goes 10, you know, 1/10 of the time to wait to retrieve something from it. It, in my opinion, even though the price seems high, it's pretty darn good. Right. Yeah, I gave it editor's choice, just because of, like, you know, just the sheer speed you can get out of this stuff, not just Optane memory as a package with the caching solution and everything, but just as there's lots of people that are picking these things up to use as like log system, like system log drives, or, you know, cause it's again, a standard NVMe part. So you don't need system support if you want to just access it as a storage device, right? Granted, not a huge storage device, but an extremely fast one. So pretty cool.
So it's funny, if you go to Amazon, the 16 gigabyte version is sold out or temporarily out of stock. The 32 gigabyte version is temporarily out of stock. The 32 gigabyte version is listed as the number one new release in internal solid state drives. And it's kind of funny, if you click on the Amazon hot new releases for internal solid state drives, number one is the Intel Optane memory module. Number two is a SanDisk Ultra 2 1 terabyte SATA drive that sells for $270. Then we get into brands you've never heard of that are selling SSDs. Any idea when the Optane memory modules will come back in stock?
They've actually been fluctuating, because I ordered a couple for myself, even though we have review units and whatnot. Even though they're all showing us out of stock, I just got an email like an hour ago saying that your product will ship on this date, and it was like not too long in the future. So I would imagine that there is volume moving. It's just that, you know, there's just a lot of demand initially for these things. People probably just want to pick it up because $44 is pretty cheap, like just to get a computer thing to play around with, right? as far as people that are interested, you know, people really interested in the technology want to know, hey, I want to see what this storage actually looks like and how fast it'll go and what I can possibly do with it. You know, So maybe some users did have that idea that, hey, I have a Z170 board and a huge hard drive with all my Steam games on it, and I just want to add this to my system and you know, use SRT and cache my big Steam drive. And it'll totally do that. Like we confirmed that this morning. So
there you have it.
Yep.
Oh my goodness. Got a chance to look at some new monitors from Dell this week on Tech Thing. The S family or the S series is the new roundup of monitors from Dell. 22, 23, 24, and 27 inch versions, all 1080p. Panels look great. Of course, we had hand selected review models in here to take a look at a Tech Thing, but lighting looked even, backlighting looked even, colors were nice and saturated. Something that's interesting about those is the pricing on them. Right, I mean, my favorite monitor, Dell's U3415, the big curved monitor. It's 34 inches. It's 3440 by 1400, which is way higher resolution than most people are using. Probably will require you to upgrade your GPU if you have an older GPU. But, you know, the 22, 24, 23, 27 Dell monitors, nice-looking 1080p IPS displays. New design for the aluminum stands. It's very slim and elegant. The 23 and 27 come with a little external speaker, like 6-watt speaker that plops into the base. The less expensive monitors, the 22 and the 23, have like, you know, stereo 3-watt speakers built in. What was crazy about this is the inexpensive ones, the 22 and 23 sell for like 142 or 161 if you get the member pricing at Dell now. But the 24-inch model sells for $209, includes FreeSync, and has a really gorgeous design because it's got what they call, they've, you know, taken the idea from the Dell XPS, the infinity edge on the display, and worked it so the display comes almost all the way out to the edge of the monitor. They have one issue as far as I'm concerned. One, if you're, you know, an NVIDIA GPU user, you're going to want G-Sync instead of FreeSync. I can't really do much about that. But the there's no height elevation. There's a tremendous amount, almost like 26 degrees of, you know, yaw where you can tilt it back or tilt it towards you. Yeah, tilt. And I would really love height adjustment. I've been noticing a lot more monitors that don't adjust height. And I will say, despite the fact that I love these big, super high-resolution monitors, 1080p on the 27-inch monitor was way easier on my eyes than the 23-inch model we looked at. You know, I got to say, FreeSync's a nice touch on the two, on the 24 and the 27. And I also thought it was interesting that all four monitors offer HDMI and VGA inputs. 6 millisecond response time, like 250 candelas per square meter of brightness. I mean, basically, it's bright enough to use pretty much anywhere with the deck of a ship. The other one we got a chance to take a look at is they just announced a new 27-inch ultra-thin monitor, the S2718D. And it's amazing to realize how much of a spread there is in prices on the 2560 by 1440 monitors these days. This one's, the list price is, I want to say, $700. It's selling on the website for like $503 right now. The big thing about this one is the design is really elegant. And you're going to laugh when I say this, but the base on that is a little square aluminum box. And what's fantastic about that is all the monitor buttons are on the top front of the aluminum box. You're not reaching up under the edge of the monitor trying to figure out where they hid the buttons.
Yeah, if you scroll down, there's a profile shot. If you scroll down a little bit, you can see what it looks like on an angle. Yeah, that's a really
thin panel. And all the cables come out the back of that box. Yeah, it's a really thin panel. All the cables were out directly out the back of the base box, which I just realized is really, really nice because you're not like tipping the monitor forward and lifting the back up and trying to figure out where the HDMI port is. You just plug everything into the back and everything gets routed out for really, really easy cable management. And that was HDMI and USB-C, which of course works incredibly well if you're running one of Dell's laptops. There you go. You can see that. And it uses an external power supply, basically one of the larger Dell laptop power supplies to power it, which is part of the reason that it's so tiny. Again, tremendous amount of tilt available on that monitor, but again, not height adjustable.
Yeah.
In terms of style points, it looks really, really fantastic. One of the things that Dell's pushing with these new series of monitors is their Dell HDR. I had a chance to talk to some of the Dell folks about that. It's I am personally calling it HDR-ish, right?
Yeah.
One of the reasons is because technically you don't really have enough, you don't have enough light coming out of the monitor to do a full gamut. Although one of the things Dell said is, you know, when you're sitting 2 feet from a monitor, you don't need 1,000 nits.
Exactly.
Blowing your retinas out the back of your skull because it's a little brighter than
you need. You don't need the actual sun sitting 2 feet from your face. Yes. Yeah.
You know, if you're on the deck of a boat at the equator, your mileage may vary. But for the vast majority of users, that's excessive. But they said, you know, it's going to give you some additional color gamut. You know, it's like 99% sRGB. So it doesn't have the full color range of HDR, but they're basically saying it'll give you a little more. And that's why I like to call it HDR-ish. So it's supposed to work with HDR10. We'll see.
Yeah.
That'll help 4K content.
Potentially, that'll help you just, just make the display render color better. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not the full HDR, it's still going to be worlds better than your standard desktop display. So, might be very handy for people doing like photo editing and whatnot, as long as you've calibrated correctly, should give you some extra range.
Life itself is about proper calibration. That Dell 27 Ultra Thin does not offer FreeSync or G-Sync. So if you are a super gamer, you're probably going to go for something else. It's also not the cheapest WQHD monitor out there, but I think it is one of the most stylish. If you like that sort of swoopy aluminum neck, thin panel, I'm going to look tremendously sophisticated in my office. That might be one to look for you. And I got to say, the glass and all the panels we had in here looked utterly fantastic. The Dell 27 Ultra Thin, the glass looked really, really good. The pictures, they were shiny. And man, if you look at Steam's hardware statistics, we've mentioned this, I think, a few weeks ago. Roughly 0.5% of all Steam gamers are using something higher than 1080p resolution for gaming. So there is a tremendous amount of opportunity for upgrading to a higher resolution monitor. And in fact, a significant percentage, probably close to 48-49%, are gaming at resolutions below 1080p, give or take. So again, if you don't have a 1080p monitor, think about it. It's not a bad time. And if you have a 5 or 6 year old monitor, it's nice to, if you get a, like I was doing, I had like a 5 year old monitor next to a brand new monitor, and you start to realize LCDs fade over time. They just start looking awesome.
Not only that, but a lot of times if it's the older LCDs, the reds look orange. Like that's actually because it has less gamut. That's actually a color gamut thing. Like that could be a brand new panel and it would still look that way.
Black or is it gray?
Yeah, that too. When the contrast is horrible too. Like that is a thing. But yeah, I mean, even, like when Dell came out with their, I think 3007, like the 30 inches, but it was an HC rated backlight. It was basically all they did was change the backlight. And you could put that panel next to the older version of it, and the reds would look orange on the older one, and the reds would look actual, like, vivid red on the new one. So, this HDR thing is just, like, another step in that direction to make the colors even that much more vivid.
Hmm. Yep. So, January, Asus shows off the first 4K HDR gaming monitor running at 144 hertz. And now The Verge has a write-up, Asus Predator X27 G-Sync HDR gaming monitor does 4K at 144 hertz. Have you pulled out your credit card yet?
This is probably going to be pricey. Not only is it 4K at 144 hertz, it's HDR, so like now you're just throwing all the bells and whistles in. But Acer has a habit of following just behind Asus with basically the same exact panel. Right, it's just in a different. They put it in their own housing. They do their own kind of thing. But at the end of the day, it's the same panel with the same features. Right, the OSD might look a little different. Right. You know, other branding stuff. But aside from that, same thing. And they also have a habit of doing it for like a few $100 lower than what Asus sells their panel for, which is actually why there's two Acer Predator panels sitting on my desk right now. Asus comes out with the awesome version of their G-Sync one. I wait for the Acer version to come out. Still looks nice, not as beefy of a stand maybe, but in some cases, actually, I prefer what the stand looks like on the Acer versions, including this one, by the way. I think that's going to be countered a little bit by them adding the eye tracking thing. So that might kind of eat some of the, the lower cost that they would typically get. But I think this high end of a panel with every single bell and whistle you could have possibly added, except for maybe it doesn't do 165 hertz, It only does 144. Still more than double. Yeah, it's just, oh my goodness. they didn't put a price in their press release. That's so that should tell you something. You know, it might
be expensive.
It might be definitely on the expensive side. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Possibly. Oh my goodness. What's the update on Vega? Jeremy did write up on PC Purr. I know Ryan's been on top of this. Is Vega around the corner? This was inspired by a Facebook post from AMD Poland.
I mean, it's supposed to be soon. It's supposed to be coming. I haven't seen any floating around the office, but it's supposed to be coming.
Well, you wouldn't be able to say if you had.
I have not been briefed on anything on Vega. So, and I haven't seen anything. So,
okay.
I don't know. But, I mean, you know, I hope it's coming soon. God knows all the AMD fans definitely want it.
Yeah.
Right?
Especially, I mean, like the 500 series is fantastic, but not going to knock the 1080 Ti or the 1080.
Yeah. I mean, it basically, that part just kind of screamed rebrand the way they did it.
Yeah.
So they need
nice
something
rebrand.
Better. I mean, they're doing good. They're not having a problem selling those CPUs. Like Ryzen's pretty much flying off the shelves, as far as I understand. So now they need to do the same thing on the GPU side and get some good competition there.
Yep, 64 compute units, 4096 stream processors, and the benchmark listed like 1 and 1.2 gigahertz, which would put it somewhere above or below the GTX 1080's 8.9 teraflops in terms of computing performance. So we wait with bated breath. The EVGA GeForce GTX 1080 Ti SC2 with ICX technology review, however, is done. So the 1080 Ti launched last month, pushed the 1080 prices down.
This is like an additional product SKU for a given GPU that EVGA started doing, where this part will come with additional temperature sensors built onto the board, for example. Kinds of features that would help people that tend to be like your hardcore overclocking type that actually wants to know all of the nitty gritty of like what's going on with my GPU right now. I want to squeeze the most out of it. Like, what's the thing that's causing me to be limited right now, temperature wise or whatnot, right? So EVGA added support in their Precision X overclocking software that kind of, you know, understands what these extra features are on these boards and gives you kind of nifty little, you can pull up a diagram. Actually, they'll show you like the layout of the board and where the temperature sensors are and like what the temperatures are and whatnot. Kind of like some extra bells and whistles added to the product. And it's already, it's already a good cooler. It already has like the super clocked, in this case, SC2. Like, you know, it's a little bit higher binning of the GPU. It comes factory overclocked by a little bit, presumably with the ability to push it even further. It looks, it's nice, just a nice looking part. I think it was just the 1080 that Ryan looked at before that had similar features. Right. And there's actually, if you look for where the logo is lit up on the side of the product, I think a few more pictures down from where you're looking at, you'll see it's lit. It's a lit GTX 1080 Ti logo, but then there's three LEDs above that. And those actually correspond with different temperatures of the GPU, the voltage regulator modules, and the RAM, I think is what those correlate to. So it's able to even give you ideas of like what part of the GPU is hitting a temperature limit first, or when, right?
I also got to say, along with there's 9 sensors on the ICX technology, the fans are asynchronous, so they can basically, you don't have to operate the fans on full all the time. RGB lighting is built into there, including the product name and the thermal display system. So it's very much a luxury card. And I just want to say this, because I never say this about GPUs. I really like the design, the thing that holds the mount that holds the fans in place, that sort of skeletonized aluminum.
I will say it looks metallic. It's actually a plastic piece. They did a very good job making that look like a cast aluminum piece. Yeah. I even went over and looked at it in the office, like in person. Like, I just had to look at it up close, and it really does look like it's an aluminum piece. It doesn't need to be metal, or like metal or plastic doesn't matter functionality wise, honestly. But I just really like the look of that card. When Ryan looked at the previous version of this, I think it was like close to a $40 upcharge over the model that didn't have the extra features, and now it's supposedly only a $20 upcharge. I think it's eventually going to get to the point where just all the VGA boards just come with this thing. But I think with the first version, they were trying to gauge what kind of demand would there be for a thing. You know, should we add these things to this board? Because obviously it costs a little more. They have to do a slightly different design, right? They have to add features to their software. Right. I would venture a guess that their feedback was enough so that, you know, again, first, they did a second version of it with this part. And, you know, the price premium was not as much addition. If I was going to spend upwards of $700 on a GPU, you know, what's another $20 for, you know, some added functionality that might actually let you squeeze a little bit more performance for your dollar out of it? It probably would end up balancing out in the end to the extra $20 worth, you know, of performance that you're able to squeeze out of. But you have to be the kind of person interested in squeezing that out of the thing in the first place, right? If you're just going to plug it in and not adjust a setting, not even install the overclocking software at all from EVGA, then it's, you know, don't spend the extra $20 if you don't have to, basically. But
yeah. But it's, yep. I mean, we're looking at the benchmarks. We're looking at, in some cases, you know, a whopping 3% faster on benchmarks.
Sure.
You're not going to buy this and be like, oh my goodness, it buries my old GTX 1080 Ti.
Yeah. If you've already got a 1080 Ti, you're definitely not the person to need this part.
We should take a moment to thank our sponsor on this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. It's brought to you by Tracker. You've cut it so close. Workout, shower, you sent off a couple of work emails, breakfast. You got like 2 seconds to check the news. Laptop's in your bag, just enough time to make it to work. You're bombing. You're moving fast, people. You turn to lock the door. Oh, man. Where are my keys? Are you going to be late? No. I mean, we've all been there. But with Tracker, you never have to worry about losing your things again. Tracker Bravo, coin-sized device constructed with anodized aluminum for the thinnest, most durable tracking out there. You can locate misplaced keys, wallets, bags, computers in seconds. You just pair your tracker to your smartphone, attach it to the item you don't want to lose, and you can find its precise location with a tap of a button. Is that easy? If you can open an app and look, you can find your gear. Lose your phone? Press the button on your tracker device or ask your Amazon Echo, and your phone rings even when it's on silent. Your phone can track up to 10 devices at once. Family sharing lets you track the same Tracker Bravo from multiple phones should you have a family member that continually loses something. Not, you know, suggesting Alan or I have any of these issues. Customized two-way separation alerts so you're notified before you leave your item behind. If you've ever walked away from your bag, how would you like your phone to give you an alarm when you're walking away from your bag? Or if your bag's walking away from you, if you're leaving things at the cafe. With over 4.5 million devices shipped, the Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world. So your lost item shows up on a map, even if it's miles away. The Tracker app records its last known location. When another Tracker user comes within 100-foot range of your item, you will receive a GPS update of where your item is located. How cool is that? The distance indicator on the Tracker app will show you if you're getting closer to your items, and you got a 30-day money-back guarantee. There is no reason to not give it a try. Stop losing your stuff today. Visit thetracker.com and enter promo code TWITCH. You'll get a free Tracker Bravo with any order. That's TheTracker.com. And use the promo code TWICH for your free Tracker Bravo with any order. We want to thank Tracker for their support of This Week in Computing Hardware. Have you ever lost anything, Alan?
Frequently. Seems to be happening more often lately. Yeah. That happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That happens. We haven't seen a water block review
in a while.
Ever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maury got a hold of one. It's utilitarian. What? I wanted to say beautiful, but
I mean, yeah. You know,
it's utilitarian.
Yeah, it gets the job done.
How long has it been since Maury did like a full DIY liquid cooling build?
I don't know. I mean, he's always doing DIY liquid cooling, but it just, it's not as often that he is not frustrated enough such that he is able to also write an article on it.
This one, the pricing on this, I thought was really reasonable, right? It's the EK Supremacy MX, available at Amazon.com for $59.99 with Prime shipping. Performance PCs yep. has it for $54.99.
I mean, as far as water bottles go, that's cheap.
That's cheap. That's incredibly yeah. cheap. Even if you buy, even if you spend the extra $17 for the copper top plate on that one. And it's a nice liquid cooler. We should point out, if you've never built a full liquid cooling system, it's not just the water block. You need the water block, you need a pump, you need a radiator, mm-hmm. and you need the tubing to connect it all together. This one's really nice in that they made it, they gave you a little bit of space on the inlet and outlets on the water block itself, which having had some where there was like no space in between them, I really appreciate that. As subtle as that may sound, a little bit of extra space to work with on these can make it so much easier to actually assemble something on that one. Yep. There were some issues that Maury uncovered. Top is plexiglass.
And he managed to, I guess you have to be extremely careful with either your O-ring placement or your amount of torque that you put onto your fittings into this block, because you're screwing into plexiglass. Plexiglass does not have the best tensile strength. So, the place where the threads are going into the said water block is the thing that's under the most tensile force as you try to tighten a threaded thing into it. And that resulted, I think it's a few pages down, more down worth of scrolling there, but he has some pictures of the cracks. He actually has them boxed in the picture in red so that you can more easily identify them. At least I think you're on the right page. It is in the water block deconstructed page, if that's the page that you're on. But that's not the page. Anyway, there were some, he had some cracks and he ended up getting a little bit of leakage out of his water block. He was able to replace the lid with a aluminum version, which is, what is it? Supremacy Evo water blocks lid, like basically just swaps right on. But yeah, he did manage to get a couple of cracks and some slight leakage from the plexiglass. Plexiglass is cool with water cooling, but you end up with, either physical forces trying to crack it, or your additives to your coolant trying to fog up the plexi or just cause worse things depending on what kind of additive you're using with your coolant. Again, additional headaches associated with trying to water cool a thing and also make it look cool at the same time.
It's a thing. I mean, a single drop of water on a capacitor can, release the magic smoke from your motherboard, turning it into a paperweight.
Yep. So
to have cracks in the top of the water block scares the snot out of me. But then again, most people don't assemble a water block.
Well, sometimes just a move. Sometimes just moving the case mm-hmm. or actually moving. Like after I moved from Virginia to Texas one time, fired up the system, everything looked good. But like a day later, trying to remember what component started leaking. Something in the reservoir, which was mounted in the top of this particular case, started leaking, and it ended up finding its way to the power supply, which was in the bottom part of the case. And I visually saw a fireball leave the back of my PC case. That was an interesting experience. And also, Corsair power supplies were pretty amazing, because the power supply continued to work after that happened. Even though it had like a quarter inch of coolant sitting in the bottom of it, and it's not meant to be water cooled. Anyway.
Oh boy.
Yeah. I don't water cool anymore.
I got to say, I'm a fan of sealed liquid cooling, although the car radiator liquid cooling system is calling my name again. So
of course,
when I get bored and brave, I may take one of the Ryzen processors and bolt it up to all 5 gallons of that glory. Speaking of power and throttling and leaks, Windows 10 Insider Program was talking about power throttling. Some stuff they played around with back in January, build 15,002. One of the things they experimented with was power throttling, where you minimize the CPU's workload, or you throttle the CPU down for background tasks, stuff you're not really looking at. And they found up to 11% savings in CPU power consumption for some of the most strenuous use cases. And while you might think, like, 11%, that's ridiculous. My processor is only using 45 watts or 90 watts. You know, you multiply that times the entire Windows 10 user base, that could get really, really interesting. So things to note about that, it's only available for basically 6th-gen and 7th-gen Intel processors with speed shift technology. The Windows developers say they're trying to figure out a way to expand that to other processors over the next few months. They built a power slider.
It's pretty cool.
They added it. So if you're in battery saver versus recommended, and if you turn it off completely, it turns it off completely when you're in best performance. You can opt out individual apps from power throttling. So it's like, settings, system, battery, and then you can click on battery usage by app, select your app, and then toggle manage by Windows to off or uncheck the reduce work app does within the background checkbox. One of the things they point out is benchmark results can be impacted by power throttling. And if your laptop is plugged in, the power throttling does not apply in that case. So, and as you point out, I made it sound like this was being used on desktops, but it's really to make multitasking on mobile processors work better when you're under battery life. So. I like that idea. Anything that increases battery life, especially if it's free, is a big plus for me.
It
shows up. Yeah.
This is like one of the first major feature additions I've seen from Windows that in the past would have not been a thing until the next version of Windows, right? But now we're not doing versions of Windows anymore, or at least not major versions of Windows. Cool. It's on the preview build right now, but eventually it's going to make its way to the actual one.
It will slowly move in. Yeah. Another thing I got to take a look at this week: HyperX's Pulsar. Kingston makes HyperX or HyperX Gaming. They released the Pulsefire FPS gaming mouse. I was very curious about this because I am a big fan of HyperX's Alloy FPS gaming mechanical gaming keyboard. The mouse is interesting, right? The Alloy FPS has a very, very small footprint. Your choice of, Cherry MX mechanical keys in a bunch of different flavors, a very simple red backlighting on that one. But it's got this solid steel frame. So despite the fact that it's small, it doesn't take up a lot of your desktop, the HyperX Alloy FPS keyboard feels really, really solid. Now, the thing you were looking at right there is the new Pulsefire FPS gaming mouse. So the big thing about that, they use a PixArt 3310 sensor, and then the button behind the scroll wheel, which you can just barely see in the picture if you're watching the video, has four DPI presets, so like 400, 800, 1600, and 3200 DPI. It's got a nice feel to it. It was only about 44 millimeters high, so you can get your palm grip, your claw grip on there. And it's interesting, they used Omron switches, which are, I want to say they're related to something ridiculous, like 20 million clicks. And this is a $50 mouse, big, giant skate pads on the bottom. They may be using Omron switches on all of it because it's kind of hard to tell from the reviewer's guide versus the website. Some nice textured grips in the side of that. But the mouse only weighs like 95 grams, and then it's got a 1.8-meter cable that brings the total up to 120, 125 grams. And compared to so many of the mice we've seen, and gaming mice we've seen in the last few years, which have either built-in weight, additional weight, or the ability to customize the weight, it felt a little cheap. The tactile feedback on the buttons was fantastic. The scroll wheel worked perfectly. It felt nice. It moved fast. But intellectually, I was like, this doesn't feel right. But in reality, it actually seems to be, it felt a little cheap because it's so light. But one of the things that the HyperX crew says is like, hey, light means it's faster to move. So
over the years, I've had multiple mice where it has comes with the weights in a little box that you can add and subtract and do whatever you want. I never have installed a single weight to any of those mice. I don't want it heavier. Like it's a thing I have to drag around the desk all the time anyway. Like I want to add weight to it. I mean,
apparently not. Okay.
No.
Yeah. Well, you know, it comes in red. It's right-handed. And I got to say, it felt good. I didn't really use the two additional buttons underneath the left thumb side of it. But then again, I very rarely use anything other than the primary buttons on a mouse and the scroll wheel. Your mileage may vary. I do like a simple mouse. I do not like mice with 14 keys because they always seem to be just impossible to use. And I will say the extra large mouse skates worked incredibly well on my incredibly beat up desktop. And that was greatly appreciated on my on my part. Man, RX580 Furonix is back at it again. If you've been looking for information on AMD Radeon RX580 performance on Linux, OpenGL, and Vulkan benchmarks, Michael Larabelle did a full rig, I should say a full review on that one using MSI's Armor. And I will let you go to Furonix.com if you're interested in that. I will also point out that they talked about overclocking the 580. On Linux, which is always an adventure on Linux.
I see the first picture, and that is a command line. So trying to overclock in the command line.
Well, you know what? It's good, clean fun, kids. That's all I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, though, to kind of look at. You know, I was working with somebody recently who was having tremendous issues with a piece of hardware, but the issues weren't really with the hardware. It was the Linux drivers for the hardware. And that's, if you're curious if the hardware will work with Linux, Furonix, as always, is doing some good work. So, you know, exciting stuff. Yeah.
Cool.
Anything you can talk about? I mean, I have a question. Since we were talking about the Optane memory, right? The, the 32-gigabyte Optane memory module.
Yep.
Is there a particular hard drive you would pair that with? What's your favorite, like, giant rotating media hard drive right now? I bring this up in part because I saw my first 10-gigabyte hard drive on Amazon recently.
Sure. if I was to buy a large hard disk today that I need to use as, like, just a big drive in a system, I'd probably get something like an 8 terabyte Western Digital Red. I know it seems weird that I would choose a Red, but I would choose it so that later on, if I wanted to move that over to a NAS, I already have a NAS rated drive. And I say 8 terabytes specifically because that is the capacity where Western Digital moved over to helium filled hard disks, which, and they're based on the HGST, hard drives, which have basically, and based on, I mean, it's basically an HGST hard drive just with slightly different firmware. But all the components even looked the same when I compared them for the review of the 8 terabyte Red. And that drive has an outstanding reliability, like, track record. Just as far, you know, it's noticeably more reliable than pretty much any, vented to atmosphere hard disk. In other words, anything not helium filled. And I just think hermetically sealing a hard disk is probably the best thing you could do, right? Just the whole expose it to atmosphere thing. Just, you know, I know there's a really good filter on that little vent hole, but
yet.
I just like the idea of just seal the thing. It should just be a black box. Right. You'd never go into it. Make sure you back the thing up so a very expensive data recovery place doesn't have to go into it. Yeah, that's probably what I would do. And just like a huge, huge drive. I think they're going for like less than $300 now for 8 terabytes.
I'm laughing a little bit because I've got a Drobo 5D. Drobo has been a sponsor of This Week in Computer Hardware in the past. But I use that bolted up to my desktop. And I had two open slots in that. And I found a couple of 3 terabyte hard drives from an older NAS review where I picked up some extra drives. And I was like, oh, should I put these in? And then I realized that they were helium drives. Like a and I was just like, oh, okay, we're good. Into the thing. I didn't even think twice at that point. But yeah, the 8 terabyte NAS, the Western Digital Red 8 terabyte NAS hard disk drive is $274.99. And
yep. More
than 6 terabyte drive, I'm pretty sure, is not helium. So you want to stick with the 8 terabyte.
No, it's
drive.
Not. Yeah, the six and below in a Western Digital Red is a standard type. Not to say that that's a horrible reliability or anything. I have I currently have I think 12 6 terabyte reds spinning in my NAS right now. It's a home built NAS, which is why there's 12 in there and not like, you know, right, limited to 8 or something. But
would you go with a red over, say, if it was not your primary drive, or if you did not have something like Intel's Optane memory, would you go with like a Western Digital Black 1 terabyte drive if you're looking for a super cheap build and you needed the storage?
Yeah, you get, I mean, Western Digital Blacks are, you know, pretty relatively inexpensive still. And that's a 7200 RPM drive. So you're saving a little bit of time on your Seeks. It's still night and day difference compared to either Optane cached or SRT cached, sure, or just an SSD. But yeah, it'll help you a little bit. Obviously, if you want to run your operating system on only a hard drive, then go as fast as you possibly can on the hard drive. Unfortunately, they don't really sell Velociraptors anymore, which were 10,000 RPM. But right, yeah, I mean, you know, Western Digital Blacks are 7200 RPM drives. And then I think everything now is a blue, because you used to have greens, but I think they have changed
blues,
it.
Blues, reds, and blacks. Like I'm looking at Western Digital.
Anything that used to be a green. Yeah, anything that used to be a green is now labeled as a blue. And that generally will mean that it's probably a 5400 RPM drive.
But it's a dense 5400 RPM.
Oh, sure.
So it spins under the head faster. Well, I mean, there used to be this huge delta between 7200 RPM and 5400 RPM. And there still can be. It's just you run into it a lot less often.
Yeah.
Or you run into 7200 RPM drives a lot less often. Boy, I'm going to be... Yeah. Sorry, since Western Digital did the color change on the drives and mixed everything up again, that was just dramatic.
But the reds... The reds, I believe, are all 5400 RPM as well, but again, they're very like high track density, right? So they can they can actually get pretty darn good sequential throughputs, you know, just moving large files to and from the disk. But anytime you go to do random access, when they kind of, you know, fall on their face, but that's not what they're meant for. They're really meant for NAS drives, meant as NAS drives. But that's why I would take one of those. Yes, it's a little bit slower, but you know, consumes less power. Maybe even more reliable since it's not spinning as fast. So the bearing should last longer. All that other stuff, you know, comes into play. And especially if you took that and used SRT or Optane on top of it, that would make a pretty killer Steam drive that you wouldn't have to even second guess downloading. You know, we installed Doom on these Optane machines for the review. It's 70 gig. I didn't know Doom was 70 gig. Like that's...
You do
that's
now.
Pretty big, right? So, you know, we're getting to the point where, like, you can't, you know, even if you had your typical 250 gig or maybe even 500 gig OS SSD, you might actually have to move your Steam drive to a different drive. You know, you might not have enough room to have all that stuff, you know, just sitting on your Steam drive with all your other stuff, right? So, yeah, darn games. Those darn things games that make us push the storage technology even into higher capacities for everybody. Oh, darn. Right.
Oh, goodness. It's interesting looking at the Amazon bestsellers. Number one is a WD Blue 1 terabyte SATA 6 for $50. Number two is a WD Red 4 terabyte NAS hard disk drive for $140, which, by the way, is you can buy 1 8 terabyte WD Red for less than 2 4 terabyte WD Reds. And then you have a whole mess of the Seagate 2-terabyte Barracuda, the Seagate 4-terabyte Barracuda, the Seagate 1-terabyte Barracuda, and then the Seagate Firecuda Gaming SSHD.
Yeah, so. we had a guy in one of the guys that works in our office with us recently bought a Synology NAS, and he put I think a Seagate Iron Wolf drives as their NAS rated. Helium. It's actually a helium filled drive. I think it was like the you know 8 or 10 terabyte model from Seagate. He got. I don't remember how many he bought, but he had two of them fail on him during the first couple of days of use. So I wouldn't blindly look at the helium thing as something that automatically means the drive is more reliable. I would more do it like the drives based on the HGST type. Or branched from HGST, in other words, HGST or Western Digital.
Right.
I wouldn't go buying the HGST, like, those drives are like HE6, HE8, like, that's the name of them. They even make an HE10, right, for a 10-terabyte model. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the guys that pioneered the helium-filled drive thing. So, and there's still HE6s in enterprises and, like, still spinning. And that drive came out, like, more than 5 years ago, I think. So, you know, there's a testament to its ability to, you know, properly seal its helium, not lose any, like a balloon, and you know, and have good reliability for long periods of use. But again, doesn't matter how reliable it is, back the dang thing up, no matter what.
Oh my goodness! It's also interesting that best-selling Western Digital Blue 1 terabyte SATA is running at 7,200 RPM, and then they also have Western Digital Blues at 1 terabyte, 2 terabyte, 3 terabyte, 4 terabyte, 500 gigabytes, and 6 terabytes. Do not get a 6 terabyte Blue for your NAS.
And, no.
If it's going to be the only drive on your desktop, try to get that 7,200 RPM Western Digital Blue. Although that would be an interesting comparison, the 7,200 versus the 5,400 RPM drives.
So the reason I would get a Red, even as a single, with a potential use in a NAS later, like, it doesn't work the other way. You can't get a Blue and then just decide to start using it in your NAS, because Blue drives and any other like non-NAS rated drive, it's actually down to a firmware difference. Well, there's multiple firmware differences, but the primary one is that, say you're putting your stuff on a Western Digital Blue drive, and it's the only drive in your system, it's not meant to be in a RAID of any form. If that drive runs into a bad spot, it will do whatever it can to get you that data, up to and including, like, kind of hang there for up to, say, 30 seconds or so. NASs will time out a drive if they hang, and because it's a RAID. It's assuming that there's redundancy. So I'm just going to just dismiss that drive that's taking too long so that I can get the user what they asked for. So the Red drives, or any other NAS rated hard drive, has this thing called time limited error recovery, which basically just puts a cap on how long it's going to allow itself to take to try to recover a sector that's otherwise unreadable. So TLAR limits this, it's like somewhere around like 7 seconds, and then NASs will time out at like 10 or 15 seconds. Whereas a regular old drive, which could very well be your OS drive, you don't want to just give up after 7 seconds, right? You want that thing to try to, you'd rather sit there at Windows with your mouse hung and not able to move anything, but at least hopefully have your data be read, right? At some point. So it's kind of a trade-off there. Me personally, I'm backing stuff up. So if my, you know, if I had a bunch of Steam games on a Western Digital Red and it decided to time out on a bad sector after only 7 seconds, no harm, no foul. I'm just going to re-download the game, or I'm just going to, you know, pull some files from a backup or whatnot. So yeah, just, you have to be aware of those things when choosing your drives.
There you have it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. Mr. Malventano. I don't know how I condensed Alvin Tano.
Yeah,
Simon Theodore. Yeah, it's
you wouldn't be
insanity
the first,
over. Friend. I've been playing with adapting coolers to AMZ Ryzen processors without AMZ Ryzen brackets or AM4 brackets, which may have involved me absorbing an entirely too much thermal compound through my fingertips in the last 24 hours. So I'm going to blame the chemicals. Mr. Maventano, is there anything you can tease that you're working on over at PC Per right now?
I'm just catching up on some random SSD pieces that kind of got put on the wayside due to all of the Optane shenanigans we've been working on for the past month. So I'm happy to be moving forward past that stuff so we can get on to other stuff. Ryan is over in London. They just had a gathering yesterday at a hotel bar or something for related with PC Per and related with a giveaway of some hardware. So that was probably fun for Ryan and Josh. He took Josh with him. Oh yeah, there's Ryan. I don't think he was wearing those glasses at that event, thankfully. That's what's going on there. He should be back next week. I'm doing some upcoming traveling to cover some things that I can't talk about yet. And but you know, it's exciting. There's new stuff coming. Things are coming out. You know. Yeah.
You just can't talk about it.
I just can't talk
Shannon,
about it.
Shannon got eyeballs on with Star Trek Bridge Crew VR this week, and this was her first really serious VR gaming experience. I took a look at, along with those Dell monitors and the HyperX mouse, Daconi Audio's ear pads, which you're looking for. If you're looking for a more comfortable experience for your headphones, I was really, really impressed by those, especially since I got them They were selling them at CanJam 2017, so they were selling to everyone, not just me, at 25% off. And it was nice. I'm looking at picking up a pair of those for a set of Sony's MDR7506s to see just what it does in terms of the audio, if it changes the audio or if it just makes them more comfortable on my skull. You can find those over at techthing.com. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find more This Week in Computer Hardware over at twit.tv/twitch. And I suspect Ryan will be back from London next week. And as always, I want to thank Mr. Maventano for joining us on the show. Alan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Oh, my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Alan Maventano.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.